It's the concept of the enemy fan, Jeff Merrick. It's one of my favorite things.
The enemy fan. What's
the enemy fan? The enemy fan is the person who invades your home turf, your home arena. As a Devils fan.
So that's like Rangers fans invading what's now the Prudential Center.
Exactly. As a young Devils fan growing up, my arena would be besieged by Rangers fans, besieged by Flyers fans, and we'd even get one or two Islanders fans there as well. Now in Washington, with the Capitals, that arena is frequently besieged by enemy fans that come in there, Pittsburgh Penguins fans, probably most prominently, although when Detroit comes to town, I'm interested to see if this tradition continues. When Detroit comes to town, that's a Red Wings barn when they come to town with all the Detroiters there.
So what happens then if you say, okay, so you're Greg Wyshynski, New Jersey Devils fans. What happens if you go to MSG to watch, I don't know, the Rangers play the St. Louis Blues?
I would normally gauge it like this. Where is my team in the standings? And if it is above the Rangers, then I might wear a Devils jersey there just to disturb the shit. And that's that person that shows up to a Devils-Rangers game wearing a Penguins jersey. Or when the Flyers were good, wearing a Flyers jersey. Like, there are certain people that show up just to disturb the shit. But then there are also certain people who show up at a game and simply don't have a rooting interest in the game. So they decide to rep their own team. This is actually part of the reason why I hate the fact we don't have ties. Because if I was a Devils fan going to, say, like a St. Louis-Chicago game, I like both of those teams. I don't necessarily want to see one team go over the other. So I would like to see a bloody, gruesome, awesome hockey game that throws back to the Norris Division. But in the end, a tie would be fine with me.
So you know what you cheer for now?
What do you cheer for now?
That is not a three-point game.
Right, exactly.
Only one team picks up 2 points and the other goes away with nothing.
Precisely. So as an enemy fan, I did something I had never done before, which is I went to the Redskins-Bears game yesterday with my girlfriend, who's a big Bears fan, and I repped the Bears. Now, it's a little different.
Whoa. You repped the Bears. You're a Jets guy. Hang on. And I know sweet tweet about football, but I do know the Jets – beat the Patriots yesterday, and that
miraculously.
Is humongous big.
Yes. Well, and also they changed the rule book to allow the Jets to win, as all Patriots fans know. No, this is true. And as I said to Leahy this morning when he asked me about it, the only reason they won is because I didn't watch the game. This is like a confluence of different fan things for me right now. It's the fan superstition thing that says that if I don't watch the game, the Jets win, or if I drink pink lemonade at a certain temperature during the Devils game, they'll win. It's that kind of psychosis combined with the experience of being the enemy fan.
This is why I'm not a fan of any team. It's too hard. Honestly, maybe that's just it. It's too freaking hard to be a fan.
It's rules on top of rules.
You think it's like hard to – a lot of people say, well, how do you watch a hockey game and not have a rooting – how do you watch a hockey game and not cheer? How do you sit there like this, you know, emotionless, you know, Zen monk and just watch the game and then leave? You know why? Because the other way around – like, listen to Wyshynski talk here, folks. Listen to Greg talk about what it's like to be a sports fan. I don't have time, and I don't have the energy. I just want to see a good game.
There are literally
I don't care who wins, I don't care who loses, who dies.
There are literally fewer rules for time travel than there are for being a fan, I think, in sports, based on my world. But so I go to this Bears-Skins game, and it's a little bit different than not having – a rooting interest, because obviously I want my girlfriend to be happy, but also I hate the Redskins. Like, I've lived in the D.C. area since 1995. I've grown to really hate the Redskins, to wish ill upon them, because there's nothing better in D.C. than to see that portion of the populace depressed on a Monday or on a Tuesday after the Redskins tantalize them and then crushingly fail at football. Like, there's nothing better than that in my world. That, of course, did not happen on Sunday. The Redskins took advantage of some Bears injuries and miscues and won a very exciting football game. By the way, there's a thing at Papa John's where I think for every Redskins touchdown or point or some such, you get a free topping on your pizza. And there are now photos circulating on Twitter of people getting like 12 layers of extra cheese on their pizza. It's pretty amazing.
Are you serious? 12 layers of cheese?
It's pretty amazing. So do check that out.
Oh, I would hate to be that guy's toilet this morning.
So I had an interesting enemy fan experience in the sense that I didn't care whether the Bears won or lost, essentially, but I definitely had an emotional rooting interest towards the end of the game because I wanted to see the Redskins lose. That said, I have to hand it to the enemy fan, or the fan that attends a game as a quote-unquote neutral observer. You know, when your team – let's say it's a Sabres-Leafs game and somebody shows up in like a Boston jersey. I mean, they might have a rooting interest in seeing both of those teams lose, but essentially they don't really care. And I didn't really care all that much yesterday, but I have to say it's freeing. It's freeing to go to a game knowing you've got everything to gain and nothing to lose, in the sense that if somebody stepped to me as I was, and if you could hear it in my voice, I did cheer a little bit at the game. I'm known to do that. If somebody steps to you after the game, and I'm wearing a Bears shirt, and they start talking shit on the Bears, it doesn't matter to me because I'm not a Bears fan. However, I can come back and say, "Oh yeah, well you're 2-4 and your team name is racist," and feel fine about it because I hate the Redskins. So I was in a really plumb place as a sports fan yesterday at this game.
So it sounds like you're kind of warming to my side of the equation here,
which is
you can just go there and be lukewarm water.
Yeah,
right?
the thing that's always
Small said, like, just go and be like that guy right in the middle. Doesn't care. Be that guy.
There
be
are
the guy
a couple
that doesn't care. You always win.
There are a couple people in my life that I know are like that. You're a curious one because like other ones are guys like Myrtle, who are, you know, Johnny journalist and never really grew up living and dying with a team. You're more of a passionate guy. I mean, I would say that you have more fan qualities than you do journalist qualities, and I think that's one of the reasons you resonate.
But that's just about the game itself and more of the players than the teams.
Yeah.
Because I think I identify more with the nameplate than the crest.
See, I couldn't do that, though. I think part of the thing that has made me a hockey fan and that has made hockey become the thing that is my lifeblood is the living and dying with the New Jersey Devils for 30-some-odd years. Like, that's the thing. It's made me a fan. It's taught me heartache. It's taught me superstition. It's psychologically damaged me. It's built me up and torn me down. I mean, it's all these things. And like to me.
But the thing is, okay. But here's let's get you up on the couch here, okay?
Please.
This is your psychiatrist talking.
Are you going to bring up the fact they've only missed the playoffs like twice in the last like 25 years?
No. What I'm going to bring up is. You know that this is going to bring great anguish. Every now and then there are going to be, you know, wonderful moments of euphoria and ecstasy where your team actually wins the Stanley Cup. But those moments are ephemeral and those moments are fleeting. You know, right. You're setting yourself up for disappointment pretty much there are 30 teams in this league, right? And it's so hard to win the Stanley. You are setting yourself up to be miserable. Why do you choose to do that?
Because those
you
moments
know it's
of
going to happen.
Because well,
you're
first
just,
of
you're
all,
just pretending that it's not going
to
happen.
There is a masochistic side to being a sports fan that's undeniable. I mean, it is a
yes.
It's both a euphoric
yes.
release, but
yes.
it's also a release of misery.
Yes.
And you know, no matter how shitty your life is, you still can take a step back and say, then again, my team also hasn't won the Cup since 1967, and you can feel a little bit better about the really shitty thing in your life. For me, it's a combination of there being a cathartic release of misery through the masochism of being a sports fan, but also I'm a creature of nostalgia. I don't know. I think you are as well. I'm sure many of the listeners in our audience are, considering they put up with your Bun Cook stories. But I think that, you know, as a creature of nostalgia, I know that those moments of euphoria, those championship moments, those moments of a team coming together and doing something great, are things that I will hold on to and be able to communicate about to other fans and other people in my life for years on end. And I'll give you the best example. Before the Devils won the Cup in 95, and F you if you say half a cup, Rangers fans, the greatest moments in franchise history was 1998, when wearing those Christmas tree jerseys, the Devils advanced to the Wales Conference Final. And, like, it was a blip on the radar for most hockey fans. But for Devils fans, it was the Cinderella season. It was a franchise-defining moment, which tells you how shitty the franchise was before that. Did it end in failure? Yeah. Was it disappointing? Yeah. Did they then go in the tank for a few years, only to be, you know, emerge when the Scott Stevens stuff and Brodeur and all that stuff happened? Yeah. But you had that moment, and now you have that moment to kind of fall back on and talk about and relate to, and it becomes a part of your own DNA as a sports fan to have experienced that moment, even though it ended in failure.
You know what this used to be? You know
what?
Just listening to you talking, you know what this experience used to be, and even, you know, you have that, you know, sort of ancient Mariner-esque quality about, you know, passing on the stories from before and gather around, and Greg's going to tell you what it was like to be New Jersey Devils fans when, you know, Ron Lowe was there and they were being called the Mickey Mouse Organization by Wayne Gretzky. You know where people used to get together to do things? Hang on. You know where people used to get together to do things like this? In church.
Where's that? Oh.
In church. This sounds like, in a lot of ways, with the death of organized religion, a lot of things have gone into that vacuum. But a big part of it, I think, is sports and that desire to be part of something, that to be part of a team, whether it's, you know, Team JC or this Team NJ. Take your pick.
You're essentially right, save for one important element that I think separates sports fandom from something like religion. And I think also brings forth the aspect of frivolity that also makes being a sports fan so unique, which is that there's nothing learned from these defeats in sports. There's nothing gained. Yes, you do experience misery, and maybe you learn how to deal with your emotions as a young lad when you shut off the TV crying like I used to and throw around action figures and toys because the Devils couldn't beat the Rangers in a regular season game, as I might have. But in religion, all of the stories have a point. All of the stories are teachable moments. All of the stories are laying down a moral foundation or essentially scaring you from doing that behavior yourself. Sports fans and sports stories are odd in the sense that even if someone tells you the most horrific tale, and I once kept my roommate up in college for a full night, Joe Barrett, Shirtless Joe from Pittsburgh, my good friend, I kept him up an entire night relaying to him stories of misery of being a New York Jets fan. But did I learn anything from those stories? No, because I always then hit the reset button every season and dive back in with both feet. And that's the difference between sports and religion. In religion, the stories scare the living shit out of you because you will die in hellfire if you do not follow the path that has been laid out before you. Sports fans, yeah. Maybe you should learn your lesson, but you never do, because we all go right back into the mire every year.
But the lesson is right there for you. It's whether you choose to actually look at it and whether you choose to actually believe it. Because if you do look at it and you do believe it, then you become someone like me. And I can understand why a lot of people don't want to be like me. But here's the lesson. There is no point, zero point, in getting that upset, that emotionally overwrought over something that you have zero control over. And you know what, Wish? I'll even go you one further. It is to the point where fans create little mini traditions, and even within the team, you can't walk on the crest on the floor. That's sacrilege. Like, there are like little mini traditions and rituals that players go through, that fans go through as well, specifically with fans trying to convince themselves that what I just said isn't true, that they have no control over what actually happens in the game. It doesn't matter if you sit at that exact same seat every time your favorite team wins and you have the exact same number of beers and you have your remote control in the exact same spot and you have the exact same, it doesn't matter. You can convince yourself that it has some bearing on the game. But really, at a certain point, what your ritual turns into is simply habit, and then you're down the slippery slope of becoming me and saying to yourself, why am I getting this emotionally involved? I have zero control over it.
And to bring it back to religion, you're essentially right, because then what happens is that others police those traditions, whether it be standing on the logo, whether it be saying someone has a no-hitter in the fifth inning, thereby jinxing the no-hitter. Like, then it becomes a thing where, much like in religion, others are policing you. So whether it's my father telling me that I can't rest my ass on the pew whilst kneeling during church, or else Jesus would be upset by that because my posture's not good, or it's me as a sports fan telling someone they shouldn't put a certain name or number on the back of their jersey, as I do every other week on Puck Daddy. It becomes moralistic policing, whether you're a sports fan or a religious nut. You're absolutely right. Let's come back to that. But at the end of the day, what we are talking about is the essence of this experience, which is fanaticism. If you're a religious fanatic, you're a fanatic. If you're a sports fanatic, you're a fan. Right? I mean, that's essentially what it is, right?
Yeah, and you dig in your heels, and it's with us or against us, and every time there's an egregiousness against your team, it has to be treated with the harshest penalty possible. But when it's one of your players that does it, you have to look at the greater context and look at the victim and say, well, how much is he to blame for the actions?
Indeed.
Like, you blind yourself. You completely blind yourself.
You do. All right, everybody. That's the soliloquy for the top of the show. Coming up later on the program today.
How did that start?
I went to a Bears game, not a Bears fan, but rooted for the Bears.
Right.
Oh, and then also the greatest single moment of that experience, by the way, was when the Jets won. And in true 2013 fan form, I was watching the end of the game on my phone on the way out of the Redskins Stadium. They win the game, and then my girlfriend and I are hugging and celebrating a game that wasn't played in the stadium in which we just left, and wearing the garb of the team that just lost the game that was in that stadium. So if there wasn't a more surreal yet fitting 2013 fan moment, I don't know what it is.
So the Washington Redskins didn't put up on the advertising for the game, hey, hey Jets fans, come watch the Redskins. We'll have the Jets game on television. Oops.
Speak of the devil, question of the day. The carcass of the Florida Panthers. Elliot Friedman seems to believe that the for sale sign is up, yeah?
Everything must go, except the kids.
Everything must go. So take ye to the Florida Panthers roster. Peruse the names. Now, we don't want to know about Huberto. You're not getting him. You're not getting Alexander Barkov. You know that.
No.
You're not getting Branson. You're not getting any of the young stars. But if there is a veteran player that you think would fit on your team and you'd like to claim that player, punkdaddyblog@yahoo.com, @Wyshynski@JeffMerrick on Twitter, #NVSW. Question of the day, pick from the Florida Panthers' smoldering bloody carcass the veteran player you'd want for your team. Coming up on the show today.
Fleischman. Oh, would Brian Campbell be in that mix? You think they'd look for Brian Campbell?
I think the time to snag a Soupy might be at hand. Yeah, for sure. And then also the old man between the pipes, if you want him. Let us know who you want. Who do you want from the carcass of the Florida Panthers? Is obviously they've already been written off like 10 games into the season. Let us know. Coming up on the show, cool friggin' show today. Nice job by Matt Brown putting this together. Scott Niedermeyer at 2:20 to talk about the Anaheim Ducks and most likely a bevy of questions about us, about defensemen. Mayhaps even the arguably best defenseman of all time, Bobby Orr question, will rear its ugly head again from last week's editions. And then at 2:40, our good friend Chris Johnston from Sportsnet joins us to talk about, oh, the Cole Harbor Bowl tonight. Oh, the boys in the bun with their sticks skitting around. Nathan McKinnon versus Sidney Crosby, Colorado versus Pittsburgh tonight. And with that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Just the latest, by the way,
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
When are we going to get our first pro weed player in the NHL?
Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I am surprised that we have not seen a goaltender somehow sneak a pot leaf under their mask.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
That's a Mark Hole.
Yeah,
isn't it? Yeah, oh yeah.
Wow. That combines so many things that I love in life into one opening. But again, don't let last week's show and Mark Hole's new opening for the show fool you. Jeff and I don't smoke the weed. If you give us weed, we can't do anything about it. I mean, contractually, we can't touch the stuff. So, I mean,
contractually, I gotta look at my.
If you gave us bags of marijuana, or a hockey bag full of bricks of marijuana, or I don't know, a bong filled with marijuana smoke, we couldn't touch the stuff. So don't even try, even in a joking way.
Don't you dare.
No, sir. Leave those special brownies at home. Jeff and I have had enough. I tell you.
I don't care. You can.
No.
I don't care about those cookies. You keep those to yourself. Nope. Won't see me eating those. No siree. No way. Especially not right before you get on a plane.
Indeed. All of our listeners in British Columbia, don't you even dare try to hand us over. Hey, by the way, before we get to Scott Niedermeyer, another thing about a defenseman. Roman Hamrlick with the big old official retirement today.
Man, did he get sour pants last year during the lockout? I mean, knowing that it was his last check and he wanted to make sure he got a lot of, he got as many of those final few paychecks because he knew he was, pardon the pun, checking out. Remember that last year during the lockout?
I do. Pretty amazing that none of his owner buddies gave him a job this year, though, huh? I mean, after torching Donald Fehr the way he did.
Yeah, he really did go after him, too, about that. or missing pages?
As I wrote on Puck Daddy today in a brief remembrance of Roman Hammerlick, at one point in his career, and it was like watching the U.S. government's national debt grow exponentially by the second, at one point in his career, Merrick, a minus 138 for Roman Hammerlick.
The reverse Larry Robinson, the reverse Bob Uecker. And when you talk about two great defensemen like that, we bring on our first guest of the podcast today. He is assistant coach of the Anaheim Ducks. He is one of the greatest defensemen ever suit up in the NHL. He is Scott Niedermeyer. He joins the podcast now. Scott, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, guys.
Pleasure to have you aboard. We're just talking about the retirement of Roman Hammerlick. And, you know, you were there you thought about it for a few years before. What was retirement, like that moment that you actually realized, I'm retired? I remember talking to Trevor Linden about it, and he said, I didn't believe that I was retired until I got my teeth fixed. And then I said, okay, there's no going back. What was that retirement moment like for you, Scott, and me, Niedermeyer? Like, what was that moment you said to yourself, okay, now I really know I'm not going back?
I wish it was just one moment and it was crystal clear, but that was not the case for me. I'm pretty sure it's probably not the case for most guys. I mean, you sort of have a meter, and sometimes it shifts to retire and other times to play, and I don't know, at least for me, it was never that clear, and it just got to a point where, I think the pull to do some different things, have more time, to do things with my family and things like that got stronger than my will to play, and that was when I made the decision.
We were also talking about Hammerlick's career plus minus before you hopped on, Scotty. Scotty Niedermeyer, of course, a plus 167 for his career. Plus minus is a stat that I think people now devalue as not necessarily being an accurate evaluation of a player's worth. But when you were playing, did you ever look at your plus minus and been like, yep, there you go, plus 34 as a 20-year-old, baby? How did you approach plus minus as a player?
I think it does obviously have a pretty good reflection on your team. It's tough to go out there alone and, score goals and prevent goals. So I was fortunate playing in New Jersey. We had a pretty stingy team with a great goaltender and a lot of good players. So I there's no doubt I benefited from that. And, I think you can look at all the stats. None of them, I guess, really at the end of the day, it's about winning, and that's the bottom line. But they all have a bit of a say in things. And, but they need to be taken, I guess, with a grain of salt as well.
You know, I can recall very vividly someone from the Windsor Spitfires organization saying, you have to see this Cam Fowler kid skate. He moves like he's Scott Niedermeyer. And I said to myself, okay, he's calm down here. Niedermeyer is one of those generational skaters. He's on the Ducks now, of course. Your thoughts on Cam Fowler, and how much of Scott Niedermeyer's game do you see in Cam Fowler?
Well, I mean, I think, sort of our size, our skill set, is similar. He is a great skater, and what we're trying to work on is to use that to his advantage all over the ice, offensively, defensively, and lately he's been doing a real good job of that, especially in our own end, just getting the puck, skating it out of trouble, making good passes, getting it up to our forwards, and maybe his offensive numbers aren't quite where he'd like them. I'm sure he'd like them to be a bit better. Our power play hasn't been too good until last night, so that's where a defenseman can collect a few points, but we'll keep working on that. And he's still a young guy. He's still got a lot to learn, but he's getting better. He's a big part of our defense right now.
Another defenseman that I believe you played with but also has been very good for the Ducks the last few years has been Francois Beauchemin. I thought for three quarters of last season, Scotty, that he was a Norris-caliber-type player before I think he got a little bit banged up. Has he been a player that's improved with age, in your opinion?
I did play with him. When we traded for him when I was here, and I ended up being partners with him right away. And just a real, rock-solid player, would play hard, do the dirty jobs, block shots, drop his gloves if he had to, win battles in the corners in front of the net. And, when he plays that way, when he plays hard, plays simple, he's a really, really effective player and big part of our championship team here. And like you said, last year, he was really the rock back there for defense for us. And coming back off an injury right now, he's just trying to get his feet under him. But, again, he's out there battling, and all the guys see that. So.
Curious your thoughts on Ryan Getzlaff as well, Scott. I've said for a number of years that Ryan Getzlaff is one of those players who, when he wakes up in the morning, will decide exactly how good he is going to be that night. And if he decides he wants to just take over a game, he can. And he did that last night against Dallas. Your thoughts on Ryan Getzlaff?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, you know, he's the type of player that has just an amazing talent. You know, sometimes, you know, you can get by with maybe not, you know, moving his feet or skating as hard on any given night and still come out with maybe a couple assists or whatever. But, you know, looking back at it, again, last night, he went out and really dominated the game. He was moving. He was aggressive. You know, he was attacking. He wanted the puck. He wanted to make plays. And, I mean, no, you know, it doesn't matter what player you are. If you're the most talented player or, you know, fourth liner that's going to play 4 minutes, you need that attitude to be at your best. And, you know, it's a challenge for everybody to push that hard every game, every day coming to practice. And I think he's getting better at it. You know, he's still not an old player and still got a lot of great hockey left him. And when he's on his game, we're a pretty good team, no doubt about it.
Have you been able to ask Ryan Getzlaff or Corey Perry for a loan yet? I mean, they do have a number of dollars coming their way, sir.
Yeah, if they ever you know, have a chance to buy lunch, I won't hesitate to take them up on it. So yeah, no, they, you know, but they're great players. I mean, they, you know, are a big part of this team. When they're going, like I said, our team is pretty hard to beat, and you know, those guys have been playing together for a long time, so it's nice to have been able to keep them together and let them keep doing what they do.
Hey, Scotty, news came down last week that from the Flyers that officially announced something we all kind of knew already, which was that Chris Pronger's career in the National Hockey League is done. You guys were such an interesting story as teammates, contrasting styles, didn't really know him before he got there. How did your relationship with Chris Pronger develop while you guys were teammates in Anaheim?
Yeah, no, you're right. I met him briefly, but I didn't know him that well before we did trade for him and he came here. And it was great. I mean, on the ice, our styles were very different. So, you know, if we could be out on the ice together, and I don't know if we ever felt like we were stepping on the other guy's toes at all. I mean, he had his place. If he liked to be on the ice, on the power play, the way he liked to do things, and I'd be off doing my own thing somewhere else. And we complemented each other, I think, quite well. And our as different as our games were, our personalities are probably that different as well. But I got along very well with him, and he's a fierce competitor. I played with a lot of guys that were very, you know, winning a hockey game at all costs was not out of the question for him, and I benefited from that winning championship.
Was there ever like a – did you guys ever have to sit down and figure out the leadership thing? Because, I mean, he's such a big personality. I imagine whatever room he walks into, whether he's wearing the C or not, he's going to be a leader in that room. Did you ever have to kind of like draw up the guidelines or put a line on the floor of the room and say, okay, this is how it's going to work?
Yeah. Not at all. I mean, that was another moment where we really had our own styles, and you know, I did what I felt was best for my personality and how I wanted to lead and was comfortable with, and he did his part, and it worked. I mean, I really honestly don't remember one time where we had an issue in that sense at all. So.
Hey, sticking with that team, one more follow-up question. I can recall, well, we all can recall, you know, Daniel Alfredsson taking the slap shot off your shin pads at the end of that period, and I think it was either game three or game four, and I can remember talking to Brad May afterwards, and Mayday said that, you know, as much as you were always, you know, a quiet leader, lead by example, you know, lead by effort on the ice, he said, at that moment, you guys went back into the room, and he said, Scott Niedermayer gave us one of the greatest speeches I've ever heard in my life, and we all knew there's no way we're going to lose the Ottawa Senators after that. What did you say to the team?
Well, Mayday's a pretty good storyteller, so I'm sure he could do it more justice. I'm sure it wasn't quite that good. I'm sure he's heard some better speeches, but, I don't know. I just, I've been in a lot of situations where, you know, you get into a fierce, competitive situation, a Stanley Cup final and things like that, and just had a good feel for, you know, where our team was at and maybe where Ottawa was at after a play like that, and wanted to kind of keep our focus where it needed to be to try and win that series and win the Stanley Cup. So I've been through a lot at that point and pretty fortunate that I had those experiences that I knew really what had to be done and how we had to handle that situation. I think that's really all I said was let's not get caught up in that. Don't worry about it. I'm fine, and we're going to go win this game, and that's really the bottom line. And it was pretty simple, so not quite as good as Mayday made out the sound. But.
Hey, Scotty.
Let's not let facts get in the way of a good story here.
Yeah, indeed, right? no secret, Scott Niedermayer, that you were one of the more fleet of skate players during your heyday. Do you look at hybrid icing now and just get jealous of how many of those races you would have won and how much pain it would have saved you from collisions on the end boards?
I call it what you will, but, winning races back to the puck, I try and approach it, with a bit of intelligence as well. I try not to put myself in real vulnerable positions to take a real bad hit or to get hurt. And so I tried my best to, get the job done, touch the puck for icing, and preserve myself to be able to continue to play. So I didn't mind it. If a guy was really breathing down on my neck and I felt, maybe this is a time where, let's just be a little conservative here and live to fight another day kind of thing. But it's been interesting to watch. There's a few instances, obviously, where the players and refs are still figuring it out that caused some gray areas, and we'll see how it moves forward.
Shallow net, Scott, a blessing for forwards on wraparound plays or a blessing for a defenseman to make the first pass from behind the net?
I would say it's probably a little tougher on defensemen. I mean, the puck's going to come out of there a lot different angles now and a lot quicker than maybe it could before. So you're that's always been a tough play for defense. When a guy's got the puck behind the net, and you're trying to find out who's in front, who's dangerous, how can I take passing lanes away? So it probably just makes one of the tougher jobs for defensemen that much more tough.
Good stuff. Last one for me, Scott Niedermeyer. We had a debate last week because CBC Sports, when they were advertising an interview with Bobby Orr, called him arguably the best defenseman of all time. I'm someone who wonders if the word arguably needs to be in that statement. Do you consider Bobby Orr the best defenseman of all time or arguably the best defenseman of all time?
Well, you can argue about anything, I think, right? But, I was just a little young where I didn't get to really see him play, in sort of his prime and watch much hockey when he was doing his thing. But you watch some of the highlights and just how dominant he was and I guess how it really changed the game and gave hope for us defensemen that, we can still, have a little fun up in the offensive zone and try and get involved there. So, I wouldn't argue, I guess. If someone said that, I wouldn't argue.
So I'm going to throw a dart here and guess that it wasn't Bob Uhr, but it was Paul Coffey who was more your guy?
Yeah, no, I mean, growing up in Western Canada in the 80s, the Oilers were dominant, and they seemed to be on TV all the time, and was a ton of fun just watching all those guys play together, how much offensive firepower they had, and, Coffey getting up in the attack with those great players all the time was a lot of fun, and a great inspiration to try and copy what he was doing out there.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I didn't think you were taking your cues from Harold Snippets or anything of that nature, Scotty. So
that didn't look quite as fun, I guess.
All right, Scott Niedermeyer, thanks for joining us on the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast, and we'll talk to you down the line.
Okay, guys, appreciate it. Thanks.
Assistant coach of the Anaheim Ducks, and it is interesting the way you look at the evolution of the great skating defenseman too, and he almost, much like, passing of the torch of Netminder or something like, Sawchuk to Dryden, more of a Bernie Parent guy. But then, you look at the evolution of great skaters and, you go from Paul Coffey to Scott Niedermeyer. And who now would you consider the best skating defenseman in the NHL? Because the thing about now is, like, it's almost getting to the point where, when you look at shots, like once upon a time, there were like a couple of guys in the team that could really fire the puck, that could really, really shoot. Now everybody can, mainly because of the sticks, but, the guys' hands have caught up to the technology of the equipment and the stick. Mm-hmm. And so it's a dangerous thing to do. But do you find now that, more so than ever, because you can get away with not being a great skater as a forward. It makes it more challenging. There's some guys that are, a little bit awkward to get around out there, but they can still get the job done. Is skating now, the ultimate prerequisite for a defenseman?
It might be. And I was trying to figure out what you meant. When you say skating, do you just mean just straight ahead speed? Do you mean speed with stick handling, or agility?
Yep.
Like, when you say skating?
All of it. Not just flat out speed. Not like, which defense was going to win a race. I'm talking about a good wide stride, able to, you know, weave in and out of traffic, knowing to distribute the puck, ability to take a pass at top speed, ability to give a pass at top speed, ability, and this is more mental than anything else. We talked to Bob McGill about this a few weeks ago, the ability to, after you make a pass, to follow that pass. Because that's where the game is going right now. If you're a defenseman, you make a pass, follow your pass. Keep your knees bent. Don't straighten them up and go, ah, I made a pass. My job here is done. Because that's not the way the game is played anymore. Because, you know, once upon a time, you know, the only, ask wingers in the 80s. I love talking to guys in the 80s. Because specifically wingers. Because they'll tell you the same thing. Man, I had it so easy and I never realized it. Because as a winger in the 1980s, all I had to do on the back check was make sure the defenseman didn't get in front of me. Mm-hmm. That was my job. That was it's now, the job is, I mean, it's always a gap control game, but your job is to shorten the gap from the backside this time, and you better not let, you know, now defensemen are at least one always jumping up into the rush. Like every 3-on-2 is almost a 4-on-2 now.
With the puck, Mike Green. Without the puck, Duncan Keith.
Yeah, see, I would go Duncan Keith as the best skating defenseman in the NHL.
Yeah.
Like, hands down to me. Duncan Keith is... I know I've gushed about
Mike Green looks like before. A forward sometimes, though, when he handles that puck and on a rush. I mean, still has it. But, yeah,
doesn't have the great stride that Duncan Keith has, though.
No, Keith is an exceptional skater.
And physical.
Really good.
That's what I like about him, too, and a physical guy.
He's a special player. And that's why I always thought it was interesting. Like, much like Pronger and Niedermeyer, much like Weber and Suter, is there an answer to Seabrook versus Keith? Is it Keith? Because Seabrook's pretty damn good, but subtle.
Yeah, and you know, as we saw, had sort of bouts taking shifts off / games off.
I mean, Keith is always going to have the points, right? He's always going to be the better all-around defenseman, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder. I always wondered about Keith, and we've seen this at moments of his career. If he knows how to play... if he knows how to conserve enough energy to leave something for another day. Because when you look at Duncan Keith, and there have been stretches where you can say, oh, man, this guy looks fatigued. And you think to yourself, well, you know what? You tell a lot of veteran players, and they'll tell you, man, it is a long season. You know, don't play every game like it's Game 7. Like, you just can't. Like, don't treat a Tuesday night in Columbus like it's Game 7 Stanley Cup Final. Mm-hmm. You know, especially if you're up 3 goals. Don't kill yourself. Save yourself some energy so you're not exhausted when your head hits the pillow that night. And he was dragging your ass for the rest of the week. Because whenever you watch Duncan Keith, man, he gives everything. He's getting better at it now. He's sort of, you know, he is a veteran player now who's not, you know, that guy that, you know, I'm leaving everything on the ice tonight. Screw you guys. This is my Hall of Fame and my All-Star audition tape. No, he's a little smarter about how he plays.
Don't you? I brought up the Pronger thing with Niedermeyer. Obviously, the news last week I think necessitates that. But that relationship always fascinated me. Think of it this way, right? Here's Scott Niedermeyer. He goes out to Anaheim, signs the big contract, goes to play with his brother. Yeah. 1 year later, they make Pronger trade.
Pronger falls in Brian Burke's lap.
Yeah. I mean, and the comparison you might be able to draw, not to make this too Devil-centric, is the Devils trading for Kolbochuk, although they had Parise. I mean, essentially the same position. All of a sudden, a new voice in leadership. Because Kolbochuk is, you know, for what it's worth, and everybody has their opinions about him, the guy was a leader on that team.
Yep.
The idea that you're Scott Niedermeyer and you're there and you're the man and you're playing with your brother, you got the big contract, and then... not only does a star defenseman arrive, but a guy who is the antithesis of you. He's the complete opposite of Scott Niedermeyer in almost every way.
And the complete opposite of Nick Lidstrom. I think the complete opposite of Nick Lidstrom more than the complete opposite of Scott Niedermeyer.
But I know
what you mean.
How is he Niedermeyer-esque? He doesn't even have the same color hair, Merrick.
No, but I'm saying, like, when you let's pick this up because Chris Johnson's standing by. But when you look at the two players, I think the sort of spy versus, if you want to do spy versus spy, the history of NHL defensemen, I think it's Pronger and Lidstrom more than it's Pronger and Niedermeyer.
Let's
pick it up in a sec.
Okay, that's fine. Joining us down the line, Chris Johnston of Sportsnet here to tell us all about how the Battle of Cole Harbour will play out between the Avalanche and the Penguins tonight And it's exactly how we expected the battle to play out. Just a deadline.
He was sick of hearing us wank off about
it. Hey, listen, now, my Pronger Niedermeyer point was that, like, Niedermeyer, to me, personality-wise, playing style-wise, night and day with Pronger, yet Pronger arrives in the scene, and it just goes to show you that in these situations that a lot of people probably look at and jump on and say, how can they coexist? That question is sometimes answered with a championship.
Oh, and you know what? This one made sense, though, because it wasn't as if there was a complete overlap of skill.
No.
Like, Pronger was that's why that relationship on that team worked. Like, no one's going to confuse Chris Pronger's skating with Scott Niedermeyer's skating. No one's going to confuse Scott Niedermeyer's physicality with Chris Pronger's physicality.
No.
That's why, as much as you say, okay, they brought in this big personality on the blue line, they're completely different players. Chris is actually standing by right now. Chris Johnston joining us from the scene of the crime that will be the Battle of Coal Harbor, Nathan MacKinnon versus Sidney Crosby. Chris, how are you today, bud?
Good, gentlemen. How are you guys?
We are well. We are well and looking forward to one of three games on the board this evening, Nathan MacKinnon versus Sidney Crosby. What are the main questions that you have going into this one, Chris?
Well, it's funny because beyond the sort of obvious storyline, I'm actually curious just to see 2-7-1 teams face off against one another early in the year. And, you know, I think, you know, many would have expected the Penguins to be here at this point in the season, but obviously Colorado has been a bit more of a surprise, and I'm actually just curious to see how the Avalanche are able to handle a pretty top opponent tonight, and if these... What's that?
Oh, what? Hello?
Hello?
You there?
We're getting...
Oh, hey, Chris.
I'm getting interference everywhere. Sorry, guys.
That's crazy.
No problem. You want to call back?
No, let's try to go forward. I can hear you now.
Okay.
All right. Good start.
That was very strange. It was a ghost speaking to you. Does Mario have your phone line tapped while you're in Pittsburgh? I mean, is it that sort of thing happening?
That's Pierre LaRouche's new job, by the way, Chris, is to tap into the phone lines of reporters that are calling from Pittsburgh.
Well, it's not that.
from the MacKinnon aspect, though, have we heard ad infinitum? That he looks up to Sidney Crosby and Sidney Crosby's helped him and blah, 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 blah. I mean, there's no rivalry here, right?
Not any that I can detect, no. I think it's actually just one of reverence from MacKinnon to Crosby at this point, you know, in his career. And, you know, you're right. That was sort of the talking points of practice today, is going over their history together. And, I mean, it is kind of interesting, I think, in a big picture, how these two guys came from this one small town to be number one picks and you know, to make it to the NHL as they have. I mean, that's an unusual situation itself. And it does seem that Sidney Crosby's taken a real interest in Nathan MacKinnon's career and his development. Apparently they're texting a lot and sort of keeping up on each other. So, you know, that is something that's gone on. But right, there's no rivalry whatsoever, no trash talk or anything like that.
What do you make of MacKinnon's game early on? I know it's not even a 10-game mod of the rookie, but what do you see when you watch Nathan MacKinnon? normally on this podcast, by the way, it's me having the tech problems, but guess what Jeffy's got now?
What do you have?
Jeffy's going through the IP. Jeffy's not using the phone line anymore. And so far, 43 minutes in, so far so good.
I was really hoping the answer was syphilis, but clearly it's more phone line related.
No, but I got like a...
Aren't you, I mean, we could talk about it now, but aren't you fascinated by the fact that we had nary a technical difficulty on the two-hour show on Friday?
Well, no, because I was at the fan. I wasn't here at home.
Well, I was at home, though. That would be the show where it's like, and here with our special guest on the line, Greg Wyshynski. Hey, Greg, how are you? Like, that's what I expected to happen off the top of that show. Personally.
Yeah, then this would have been me tap dancing for 2 hours.
What have you thought of MacKinnon, by the way?
I thought he was pro-ready last year, to be honest with you. It's funny because the comparisons are always there with Jonathan Drouin. And, you know, Jonathan Drouin, you can make the argument, was a more dynamic junior player. But when mm-hmm. you watch Nathan MacKinnon play, you look at this, the skill set and the way he, you know, just like the way he moved on the ice and the positions that he went to and the things that he did, you said to yourself last year, and then the Memorial Cup was the icing on the cake, this guy is NHL ready. And he's mm-hmm. been able to fit in, you know, whatever situation and whatever line Patrick Waugh sees fit to put him on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not exactly a shock that, you know, early on he's had some success, and people are already saying, like, yeah, we knew this guy was going to be that good, and he belongs in the NHL. And he'll probably play not a single game in the minors.
No, I think you're right on that score. I like his speed. There is sort of a, I don't want to say Crosby-esque, but the way he kind of gets involved physically, I like. Much like any young player, there's in the Avs games I've seen defensive deficiencies here and there.
Let's get back to Chris. Chris, you there?
Yes. Let's hope that we can have a little bit more Christmas in the rest of this segment than the first two calls.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, ho, ho, ho. Your thoughts on Nathan MacKinnon?
Well, you know, I heard some of your conversation there, and the one thing that stands out for me with MacKinnon that maybe Crosby even didn't so much have in his rookie year, that he doesn't really have to be relied on as the guy at this point. You know, I think Matt Duchene, you know, obviously is someone who's eating up a lot of important minutes for them. Even, you know, Paul Stastny's still around. And I think that there's an opportunity for Nathan to sort of find his way a little bit more into the league. And, you know, I know Mario Lemieux was briefly around when Crosby first showed up, but that was a pretty bad team beyond that. And Mario didn't even last out that whole season before eventually retiring for good. And, you know, I think that is maybe the one benefit. He doesn't have, you know, near the same hype that Crosby did, you know, at the early stage of his career. And, you know, as you guys mentioned, he's shown so far that he can play. He's certainly not going to spend any time in the AHL or anything like that. And I think he'll get a little bit of time here to get his legs under him.
What are your thoughts overall on the Avalanche? I mean, I think a lot of us probably underestimated how good they would be. I thought the potential was there for Patrick Waugh to get something out of this team, but they are clearly ahead of schedule.
Certainly, and the biggest thing that stands out to me, I saw them play in Toronto a couple weeks ago, and then was around them again this morning, is just how light everything is. I mean, they're clearly having fun, which I guess is easy to do when your team is winning games, but, you know, I sense that Patrick Waugh, if nothing else, has done a lot to kind of lift the spirits of the players in the dressing room. I think it was a pretty tough 2 years prior to this one, in particular in Colorado, a lot of losing. You sort of hear whispers of a lot of discontent in the dressing room with the way things went, and that's all been erased now. And, you know, what you're seeing is a lot of, you know, really talented young players who are having a chance to play sort of a wide open, fun type of game with a coach that seems to get them. And it just feels right at this point. And, you know, obviously, I'm not thinking that anyone's going to predict they're going to, you know, continue on this sort of pace. But, you know, it is an encouraging start for them. And, you know, as we've seen, if the teams can stay in the playoff hunt, even in November, it's usually a good sign for them. It's much tougher to dig out of an early hole. And, you know, I think that this now looks like a team that you're going to think, well, maybe they can sort of speed things up from where most thought they were at and really challenge for playoff position as this season wears on.
At what point will you make your mind up about Patrick Waugh, the head coach? I mean, the one thing that Greg and I were talking about this last week, the one thing that Colorado is doing and has done right out of the gate that we don't see a lot of consistently, although we do see it a little bit occasionally when pucks are directed at the net, is they play a man-to-man defense in their own zone. And, you know, the way to break that is you start treating like basketball and you start setting picks, or as they call it in hockey, as you know, Chris, switches. Oh, no, it's not a pick. That's basketball. We set switches here, not picks.
Yeah,
and, you know,
I mean,
listen,
I think that we're going to have to wait a while still to see how, you know, Patrick, it's almost, first we got to wait to see how the other teams adjust to him and see how he
yep.
can maybe restructure things back. But, you know, certainly I think the book will be written on him a little long way from now. And, you know, it's very easy, I'm sure, in some ways to come in and have a quick impact. I mean, we see it a lot of times even when coaching changes are made, you know, during the season, say, where teams, you know, go on a good run initially. But, you know, to me it will be about what kind of staying power he can have, how he can maybe even help some of these guys reach higher levels. And, you know, as you mentioned, when they start to maybe detect some of the things he's doing, to see what adjustments he can make. And, you know, the interesting thing, I guess, is that so much focus, of course, is on the fact that he's a Hall of Fame player, and that in itself is sort of unusual to see, you know, that sort of guy become an NHL coach. But, you know, having spent so much time in junior, he actually, you know, does have a pretty serious coaching resume, I think. And, you know, maybe that's overlooked a little bit because of who he was prior to that. But I think he seems very ready for this opportunity, and let's see if he can hold it together here. Well, we certainly saw his passion on the first game of the season with Bruce Boudreaux. I wonder, you know, if that sort of thing will reemerge, or if maybe that was a one-off because of the situation. But I think all those sort of questions have to be answered in time to see how he reacts to losing streaks and things of that nature, you know, before we really know if this is going to be a successful experiment for the Avalanche.
Look, I know that this has been a nice respite for you to go cover this Penguins Avalanche thing, because you don't have to answer a bunch of stupid questions about the Leafs. But I'm going to ask you one anyway.
All right.
What do you think is going to happen with Phaneuf and this contract?
Honestly, I think he's coming back. I really get that feeling that he will, but it might not play out very soon. I still think that the Leafs are going to wait and see as much time as they can to sort of get a read on him and things like that. I mean, as far as I know, they still haven't had any discussions, but, you know, I still think that this guy comes back to Toronto. I know he really likes it there, and I do think the team, you know, appreciates having him. So, you know, this one isn't nearly as hot button as Kessel would have been, because I think, you know, had that Kessel extension not got done, there would have been a lot more focus on, do they trade him? Is he going to leave? You know, because he'd made it so clear that he kind of wanted to know what direction this was going in. This one isn't yet sort of sparking hot, because Dion doesn't seem to be in any rush to get anything done. He doesn't mind negotiating during the season. And, you know, I just feel like this one will sort of get done quietly on the side, and he'll remain a Leaf. That's my gut on it anyway.
And he holds all the cards here, Chris. Like, he holds everything here, CJ. You look at the unrestricted free agent market in the offseason. Dion Phaneuf, should he decide to test and see what's on the other side of the fence, he can make himself a wealthy man beyond even his wildest dreams.
That's true. And, you know, I guess also for the Leafs, they have five. He's one of five defensemen of the regulars right now who becomes a free agent next summer, whether UFA or RFA. And, you know, I think as a result, I mean, going back even before training camp when Cody Franzen was kind of having his standoff with the team, I think one of the main reasons they wanted to get him on a two-year deal, in addition to trying to lock him up at a fair number, is it was more just to, you know, have some stability there. So I just don't think they're going to want to have the whole blue line turnover. And Dion has actually been, you know, decent so far in this season. I mean, the team's defense hasn't been great as a whole, and, you know, he obviously logs the biggest minutes, but I think he has been one of the bright spots so far for most of it. And, you know, I do think that the Leafs like him enough and that he wants to stay. And, you know, I really do think that's how this will ultimately wrap up.
And that's how we ultimately will wrap up, Chris Johnston. Thank you, Captain Segway. Enjoy the Battle of Cole Harbour tonight, and we will talk to you soon, sir.
Yes, indeed. It's also the J.S. Jaguar, Marc-Andre Fleury battle. A little less attention on that, but we'll watch that one, too.
In which both of them will be the second and third best goalies on the rink tonight, is what you're trying to say.
Exactly.
Thanks, CJ.
See you guys.
The great Chris Johnston of Sportsnet joining us on the Merrick Ryszczynski podcast. By the way, Merrick, you'll be happy to know that Big Leagues, the number one and I'd wager only sports bar in Cole Harbour, offering $10 pitchers tonight.
Hey.
As you go to watch
nice.
Sid versus Nathan, the Battle of Cole Harbour, at their fine establishment. I actually called them up to see if they were doing anything special. I fully expected, you know, 87-cent shots or something of those. No, just cheaper pitchers.
87 cents? Jeez.
Wouldn't that be great?
I
only do this because for Sid's 21st birthday, I called a bar in Pittsburgh and let them know, asked them if they were doing anything special about for Sid becoming quote unquote legal here in the States, as if the kid couldn't get a drink in town before that, right? And I called a bar in Pittsburgh for Puck Daddy and asked them if they were doing anything special, and they said no. They're like, should we? I'm like, well, yeah. I'm like, you know, his favorite beverage is Crown Royal. And so they did a Crown Royal shot special that night for Crosby because we called up and asked if they were doing anything special. So I felt like we really did our service to the fans of Pittsburgh with that phone call.
Is Crown Royal his favorite drink?
Yeah. Well, really? That's what he said in an interview once. Yeah, he said Crown Royal is his favorite drink.
Huh. Now, here's a question about Cole Harbour. What's the name of the sports bar?
Big Leagues.
Who's Big Leagues
Why?
Cheering for? Who do you think they're cheering for? Let's bring this back, conversation right back to the beginning of the podcast. Are they cheering for the latest flavor of the month? from Cole Harbour, or are they cheering for the guy that really helped put that town on the map?
I would say
the Penguins bar, is that an Avalanche bar?
I think it's a Penguins bar. I can't imagine that there'd be more support for MacKinnon than Sidney Crosby. Do you?
I don't know. He did win a Memorial Cup last year. Lit the province on fire.
It's like if you're an American swimming fan and you've got Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte in the same pool, right? Like, you'd like to see Ryan Lochte make a race of it, but ultimately you'd like to see Michael Phelps win another gold.
I see Michael Phelps. Yeah, you're probably right.
Uh-huh.
You're probably right about
this. Uh-huh.
You're probably right.
The smoldering blood. Oh, before we get to the smoldering bloody carcass of the Florida Panthers and our question of the day, let's talk about hitting for a second, because more stretchers, more injurious hits, all this jive. I was and this is, you know, a twisted thing to say because Dustin Penner was a little bit banged up on the play, but I was actually happy in some ways to see Ryan Garbutt deliver a classic sprung from the penalty box leaping headshot on Dustin Penner, harkening back to the ye olden days of Matt Cook, back when Matt Cook was Matt Cook, taking a shot at Penner after he either shot or passed the puck. He was in a prone position. It was refreshing to see a hit like that after all of this gray area that we've had in the last week or two.
So you're just happy that this one was cut and dry, black and white. Mm-hmm. We know what this thing is. There's
give
no
me heroes
matter
and villains
for debate.
Give me a leaping headshot like the one delivered by Garbutt over the spinning Nick Cronwall, oopsie-daisy, I didn't mean to really hit him that hard kind of thing that happened with McLeod. Yeah,
let's hit totally. Cronwall in a second here, but you know what I loved about, I guess he's probably started it last night and well into this morning. You know what I loved about that entire situation with Dustin Penner and Ryan Garbutt? Did you see
his
Dustin
Twitter rant?
Do you see, like, Penner's going at people on Twitter who are criticizing him over the hits. Like, right back at people. Penner took, like, I don't know when it happened. Maybe it happened when he was back playing for Maine. Maybe it was when he was with the Anaheim Ducks, Oilers, who knows when. But somewhere along the line, and it happens to a lot of people, sometimes, you know, there's a certain point of your life where you've taken what I like to call an I don't give an F pill. And once you take that I don't give an F pill, you really don't give an F. And that's what it seems like Dustin Penner was doing last night on Twitter. I don't care. I'm just going after people.
Right.
And that's what he was doing. Now, here's the thing about Ryan Garbutt hit,
very
too.
Very freeing, yeah.
Saw it yesterday. I thought, man, if I'm an NHLer right now, because hitting, as we've talked about countless times, is not a perfect science. And the ability to lay the perfect clean body check is incredibly hard. It's remarkably difficult to lay that perfect shoulder in the chest body check that we all say we love so much. And then you get, you know, bodies moving different, you know, the different directions, and everyone has a different height. No one's the exact same size as everybody else. So if you're trying to lay that perfect body check, you know, and around the upper chest, chances are, since this isn't a perfect science, you're going to hit someone in the head, right? With your body checks.
Right.
And now
right.
the Department of Player Safety coming down on players left, right, and center, and we can argue the merits and demerits of that all we want another time. But if you're a player in the NHL right now, why even take the risk? Now, I'm not saying don't hit, but if I'm an NHLer right now, you know where I'm hitting, Wish?
Right.
I'm hitting low. I'm staying so far away from the head. Yes, I'm going down. I don't want to hit someone in the knees. But if I'm an NHLer, I am going low. Because if I know, you know, it's hard to make a perfect body check in the upper chest region, I'm staying completely away from the head, but I still have to make a hit. This is still a contact sport. Are you surprised, as I am, that more people aren't hitting low? Just to try to stay. I remember talking to PK Subban when he worked with us during the lockout last year at Sportsnet. I said, you know, why do you hit with your ass? He goes, to be honest with you, I don't want to get someone in the head because I don't want to inadvertently destroy someone's career. And B, I don't want to get suspended. So
yeah.
That's why I stick my ass out and hit.
It's the lesser of two evils, though, at the end of the day, isn't it? I mean, honestly.
Yeah. Like, take
it really,
pick. Like, I'm shocked more guys don't go low, really, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I. And then when do we get to the scourge of the low hit, right? Like, for the first time.
And then we'll come back. Then we'll come back to the point that I've been making forever. Hitting is not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
and stuff's going to happen as long as you allow a contact game.
A couple things before we get to the Panthers here. Jason Butler writes in, unfortunately, Sid's turned one half of the population in Cole Harbour into Penguins fans years ago. Hashtag yeah. Fairweather, hashtag Halifax. Chris McElwain brings up a very good point in our conversation about really, really speedy players. Jeremy Ballison says the same thing. Erik Karlsson, obviously, is a name that we probably should mention in that conversation.
Not having the best year, though.
No.
Not since, been the same since the Matt Cook injury.
And Ballison does say, what about Karlsson pre-injury? And I think
yeah,
we'd agree.
Absolutely.
Pre-injury,
yep.
That guy was
totally
skating like the wind, baby.
Yep.
Skating like the wind. The question of the day was, which veteran player would you pick from the bloody carcass of the Florida Panthers? Obviously, a team being written off just a scant 10 games into the season. This is from Erica. None of them because the Devils are old enough already. Should we prepare for a Scott Gomez reunion after trade deadline? No. This is from, let's see here. Mike Barba. Stanley C. Panther. None of their veterans are desirable in my opinion, so I'll take the mascot instead.
Wow.
Yeah.
Stanley C. Panther. I thought we'd get a lot of, Sean Mathias, to be honest with you. There's a guy who I still think has tons of potential.
You think he's a Nathan Horton, just you have to spring him from that
maybe.
Situation type?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Big body, what is he, like 6'3", 6'4", 220 pounds? Move his feet.
Drunk Peter Puck says, is John Van Briesbrook still available?
I just love the name of the Twitter handle.
Rob McGregor writes in, Brad Boyce, $1 million for a veteran winger who can give you 20-plus goals? Hell yeah. Well, you know, 20-plus goals in the right situation.
He's got like 4 or 5 with Florida already this year.
Conrado Padreas writes in, Padreas, have the Canucks trade for Tim Thomas so he can pump Luongo's tires going into the playoffs? It's a scenario we've talked about before. Yeah.
How hilarious would it be? Well, not hilarious if someone has to get injured for this to happen, but how hilarious would it be to see Tuukka Rask go down, I don't know, blow out his knee, that's the end of his season, to hear Peter Chiarelli and Dale Tallon talk trade for Tim Thomas. And then have every Boston writer scramble to try to undo all the things they've said about him in the last year.
That would be pretty awesome.
Yep.
Andrew from the Dry Island Castaways.
Great name.
How about the ginger coin purse? I imagine he's talking about Brian Campbell.
Brian Campbell? That's right. Yeah.
And this
way
is
to go,
also...
Way to go, Greg Yashinsky. You gotta go. You gotta put the coin purse on, the on your blog.
I know. This is from Daniel D. Florida Panthers fire sale. I take Brian Campbell, solid defenseman that has Stanley Cup experience. Although my Coyotes are not in need of defensemen, he seems to be arguably the best veteran on the roster. So I vote for Brian Campbell.
What's Frostiga left on his contract? Hang on.
You know, having Cap Geek open would have been a pretty good idea
at this point.
Because a lot of those guys do have like 2 years left in their deals. It's not a traditional, here go the UFA's kind of fire sale. These guys do have some time in their contracts still.
We were trying to figure out my IP situation here like 2 minutes before we got on the show.
Mm.
A lot of that was my fault, I'll admit. But so that's why I don't have the cap.
Here's
open.
Zach Walker.
Let's see. Hang on. Versteeg's got two more at 4.4 a copy. That's a tough one.
Zach Walker makes the case that the Chicago Blackhawks should be back in the Brian Campbell business. Despite having one of the best defense corps in the league and a limited salary cap, the Hawks getting Brian Campbell back would be like a wet dream. Ever since his trade, the Hawks' power play has been in decline. Keith Seabrook, Letty, and even Michael Roosevelt have had their stints at the top unit. Soupy's return would work wonders to boosting a unit ripe with talent back in the top of the league. Oh, but what? What, Johnny Oduya doesn't do it for you as far as puck moving defensemen, sir? Like Brian Campbell back?
Would they even have room to welcome him back?
No. You can't imagine with the cap situation there they would. Nope. Finally, here is one that I will read. Mike Weaver back to St. Louis. Oh. Underrated penalty kill and beard growing specialist. Gives us great depth for our Puck Daddy Stanley Cup playoff beard watch run. This guy can grow a beard with the best of them. With love, David Backes, St. Louis Blues captain, amateur pilot, all-American badass. Actually from Nick. Not really from David Backes. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that, friends, is the show for today.
What didn't we get to? Hey, Mike Smith scored a goal over the weekend. How did we not
he
talk
did?
About that?
He did. Because, you know, honestly, until he gets to where Brodeur is in career goals, what's the sense of talking about him?
Should we stop being so impressed when a goaltender does this?
No, no. It happens rarely, right? So, like, I still think it's a big deal when it does happen.
To me, I think if you looked at the goalie landscape and you said to yourself, okay, which goaltender has the biggest potential to actually score a goal, we'd all say Mike Smith. I just love that it came with 0.01 seconds left. And here's the other thing, too, and we've seen this happen before. And if you're a coach, it drives you nuts. Good for Mike Smith. I mean, Mike Smith had the, you know, they were up, what, 4-2 at that point when he took the shot? 5-2 final against the Detroit Red Wings? If it's a one-goal game and you see your goalie going for an open net, do you freak out on him? Even if he scores the goal.
What do you mean freak out on him?
Dude, it's a one-goal game. You're up by a puck, and he's shooting, and empty, and he's shooting for a he's shooting for a goal, and it could cost you an icing penalty. Puck right back in your zone, face off right beside you.
Yeah, there you go. All right, I gotta run.
Oh, okay. You want me to blast a little bit? Want me to blast a little bit at the end of the podcast today?
Too? I'm in. Don't go crazy again. I'm in a conference room, and we ran long, so I have to get out of here.
Okay, you go. I'll finish off the podcast.
Oh, Jesus, this again. All right, everybody. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.
Oh, there goes that asshole. All right, folks. Thanks for joining me and Greg today.
I'm not an asshole. I'm not an asshole.
Greg's gone. Thanks for joining us today. Martin Biron, newly retired netminder, formerly from the New York Rangers, will be on the podcast tomorrow. So thanks to everyone who tweeted in. Thanks to all of our guests, Scott Niedermeyer, Chris Johnston. Three games on the go tonight in the NHL. On Sportsnet West, I will be doing the... What am I doing today? Oh, Calgary and the Los Angeles Kings. The audition for Sean Monahan continues with the Flames. We'll be working with Neil Smith and... I don't know if this is his debut as an in-studio analyst. Greg Millen will be on the panel tonight, so that should be a lot of fun. All right, we're out of here. Thanks for joining us today, and thank you for everyone at the Sportsnet 590, the fan tech department, for helping me set up my IP address here with my tie line box. Because, guys, you have no idea how good it feels to do an entire podcast and not have any dropouts or not have my bitrate drop at all. It's so nice. Hopefully this is the end of our podcast tech drama. Having said that, I know I've cursed it, but nonetheless, for 60 minutes, it has been flawless and it has been heaven for yours truly. Thanks for joining us today. Podcast returning tomorrow, 2 o'clock Eastern, stream live, sportsnet.ca and Puck Daddy. And then on iTunes, March? No, trade deadline. Trade deadline. This show will be up by trade deadline. So enjoy it, and we'll talk tomorrow. Bye.